Therefore he looked again and again, even until inward springs of water flowed down his cheeks. Now as he stood looking and weeping, behold, three shining ones or angels approached and saluted him with the benediction, "Let peace be upon you." Now, on the right-hand page there at the bottom there, you'll see some footnotes there which give some explanation. Look at the outline too, just above that you'll see, when he now comes to this awakening that his burden has been released, we have what we call his experiential benefits. There's four of them. He has a glad, restful, animated heart. Two, wonder and astonishment, the power of the cross. Three, springs of living water flowing from within. And fourth, peace with God. He also has declared benefits which the angels provide for him. But before we turn the page to those, look at these footnotes here. Again, this is the explanation I believe that is right in terms of what's happening here. And you tie in grace abounding to the chief of sinners. This is Bunyan's own personal conversion testimony. Now, one, note Bunyan's conversion, grace abounding. I've got the references here. You can study this out. His further struggles, again, conversion, notice in grace abounding paragraphs 113 to 115. His further struggles in paragraphs 135 to 202. Then assurance comes to him, 229 to 235. Christian here, in now losing his burden, represents this order. We are given, really, in Pilgrim's Progress, a distinct representation of John Bunyan in the person of Christian, you see. So that this is not the place of his conversion. This is the place just a little way down that track. Notice that it comes straight away after instruction at the house of the interpreter. Then he suddenly realizes, my burden has been released. He bore my sin in his own body on the tree, the just for the unjust, that he might bring me to God. That's what he understands, you see. That's the point here. Now, over the page, and we see these declared benefits. First page 54, so the first shining one said to him, your sins have been forgiven. The second stripped Christian of his rags and clothed him with a complete change of garment. The third also set a mark upon his forehead and gave him a scroll with a seal on it, which he directed should be looked at as he ran, and handed it in upon arrival at the gate of the celestial city. So these messengers went their way. Then Christian gave three leaps for joy and went on singing, thus far did I come laden with my sin, nor could anyone ease the grief that I was in until I came here. What a place is this? Must here be the beginning of my bliss? Must here the burden fall from off my back? Must here the cords that bound it to me crack? Blessed cross, blessed sepulchre, blessed rather be the man that there was put to shame for me. You can see that this man has been converted. He's truly been saved by the Lord Jesus. Yet he's very untaught in the gospel. He gets more teaching at the house of the interpreter. Then suddenly he jumps and he sees it far more fully, all that Christ has done. Incidentally, when you became a Christian, did you understand all of Romans and Galatians and Ephesians and Hebrews? Do you understand all that? Of course you didn't. But what you did know is you're a sinner and you believed in the Lord Jesus, and suddenly light came instead of darkness. And suddenly you saw it. Yes, he died for me. You saw substitution. You saw the pure grace of Christ saving you. Nevertheless, you go to church now regularly and you're reading your Bible, but there's so much to learn. And there's so much to learn about the gospel. Now look on the right-hand page here. Here are these four declared benefits of the angels. One, negative justification, the forgiveness of sins. If you like, the bearing away of sin. He bore my sin, you see, in his body on the tree. Negative justification. Justification also has a positive side, and that is the garment of Christ's righteousness. This is very important for Bunyan. That's why I pictured it here for this pilgrim as a garment, which Isaiah describes and so forth. It's the imputed righteousness of Christ. I'm covered in the righteousness of Christ, you know. That is my great hope and boast, you know. And that's the point. So justification is negative, take away my sin and guilt. Positively, it's the imputing to me of the garment of Christ's righteousness. And we'll see this come up quite a few times, because when Pilgrim travels, he's got this garment and maybe he's getting into trouble. What does he do? He looks at his coat. His coat encourages him. It restores his assurance. Third declared benefit, a mark on his forehead. And if you look at your notes, you needn't turn to this. In the footnotes on the left-hand page, there's a passage in Ezekiel 7. I tend to believe that that's what he has in mind. Ezekiel chapter 9, I should say, verses 1 through 7. And there you've got God saying to Ezekiel, go through the city of Jerusalem. Can you find any righteous man? One righteous man. Any righteous man? Any righteous here? Well, if you can find one, put a mark on his forehead. I tend to believe that is what he is referring to here. Because now this pilgrim is a righteous one. It's imputed, if you like, and then his whole life is more one of virtue and godliness and interest in those things. And so he's distinctive, and he's like, again, is there a righteous man in Jerusalem? Well, now this man is a righteous man, both declared and even the way it's working out in his life. Thirdly, a sealed roll for his journey. This becomes very important. He carries it with him, and you're going to see him lose it, then he regains it, and then again he looks at it, he reads it. He's told, you keep reading this, as it were. And this here, this sealed roll, I've put on page 54 at the bottom here, is the pledge of his inheritance that brings with it assurance, the down payment of the Spirit, if you like, as an engagement ring. The scroll is an indication of authenticity, because we know, he's told, when you get to the gates of the celestial city, hand in your scroll. That will mark you out as an authentic pilgrim. And if you come up to that gate and you haven't got your scroll, you won't get into that city. All right. So, therefore, the straight way ahead is a way of rejoicing. It's a way of assurance. It leads to singing. I love that little line there again. Must here be the beginning of my bliss. Must hear the burdens bore. Must hear the burden fall from off my back. Must hear the cords that bound it to me crack. Blessed cross, blessed sepulchre, blessed rather be the man that there was put to shame for me. There's the indication of a true Christian. Rejoicing, singing about Christ crucified for him. Let's turn over the page. When we become new Christians, often we see things through such rosy glasses, and everything's new, and we can see, and we see what the world, the flesh, and the devil's about, and we see the glory of maybe the Word of God and other Christian believers. We love them. These all are changes that come to us. And so we are in life and we see some people, and you're like Christian here. He comes across some people, supposedly pilgrims, but they're dozing and snoozing along the way. Let's read this here. I saw then in my dream that Christian went on his way, that is, until he came to the bottom of the hill. And there he saw beside the way three men fast asleep with chains attached to their necks. The name of one was Simple, another was Sloth, and the third was Presumption. And of course, Christian's really moving along, and he's thinking everyone should be going at the speed I'm going, and these people are dozing and snoozing and sleeping. He hasn't seen this. This is strange. Why do they do that? We read on. Upon Christian seeing these pilgrims dozing on the ground, he approached them with the hope that he might be able to awaken them, so he exhorted them. You are like those who fall asleep on the top of a mast, for the Dead Sea is under you. That is a gulf that has no bottom. Therefore, rouse yourselves. Be on the move if you are willing, and I will also help you to be relieved of your shackles. He also told them, if he who prowls about like a roaring lion, that is Satan, seeking whom he may devour, he should come upon you, you will certainly become prey for his teeth. To this they merely glanced at him and replied in the following conceited manner. Simple naively answered, I do not see any danger. Slothful mumbled, just let me have a little more sleep. Over the page. Presumption proudly said, every tub must stand upon its own bottom. What he means here, I'm independent. Who do you think you are trying to advise me? What do I need? I don't need your advice. So they all lay down to sleep again, while Christian decided it would be better to be on his way. Even so, Christian was troubled to think that men in such obvious danger should so lightly regard the kindness of he who freely offered them assistance, that is, by volunteering to help them be relieved of their shackles. It reminds me of the verse in Ephesians there where the Apostle Paul says, walk circumspectly, redeeming the time because the days are evil. And I often describe walking circumspectly as like walking through a minefield or a cat in a hot tin roof or something like that, you know. I mean, when you walk circumspectly, you walk very carefully. There's danger. And that's exactly what these three here are totally unaware of. Over the page. Now, here we have some other pilgrims traveling along, except they're plainly counterfeit. The essence, this is concerning formalist and hypocrisy, and they are clearly counterfeit. Why are they counterfeit? The essence is they haven't come in through the wicket gate. Let's read here, page 60. Now, as Christian reflected on this disturbing encounter, he noticed two men come tumbling over the wall on the left-hand side of the narrow way, and they'd hurried along to catch up with him. The name of one was Formless, the name of the other, Hypocrisy. So, as I mentioned, they drew near, and Christian commenced a conversation with them. Gentlemen, from where have you come, and what is your destination? We were born in the land of vainglory, and are going to Mount Zion for the purpose of receiving praise. Well, that tells you. Right-hand column there, a little way down there. Christian, but will not your custom be regarded as a trespass against the Lord of the celestial city to which we are headed, and thus a violation of his revealed will? Well, don't you trouble yourself about that. The reason is that their manner of entry has become a long-established custom. In fact, many witnesses would testify that it has been accepted as an established route for over 1,000 years. Notice again, what's authoritative here? Not scripture, tradition. Nevertheless, will your practice stand up to investigation in a court of law? We believe so. There it is. Here, look at this. Our tradition has been accepted for so long, that is, for well over 1,000 years, that it would doubtless be admitted as a legal ordinance by any impartial judge. However, practically speaking, we are now in the way, so what does it matter how we got in? If we're in, then we're in, as we understand it. You're in the way, having entered through the wicket gate. We're also in the way by means of tumbling over the wall. So how is your present condition any different from ours? You hear people? Well, I go to church. You go to church? We're both Christians. That's a delusion, isn't it? You know? My car is in the garage. I'm in the garage, so I'm an automobile. You know what I mean? I mean, it's so crazy, isn't it, really? Well, over the page. All right. I know you smiled at this. You can see the timelessness of this, isn't it? Yeah. It's not ancient at all. All right, read on, page 62, Christian. I walk by the rule of my master. You walk according to the uninformed working of your imagination. You're already considered to be thieves by the Lord of the way. Therefore, I have little doubt that you will be found to be illegitimate pilgrims at the end of the way. You enter in by your own devising without his direction, and so you will leave by yourselves without his mercy. You'll notice here is a principle brought out that is so common today. How do you go to heaven? Do you go to heaven on your terms or on God's terms? That's the issue, isn't it? After all, God has his own territory. His territory, especially where he resides, is heaven. Does he not have the right to populate his territory as he thinks fit? And who do you think you are? You can say, well, I think I can go to heaven on these terms. You will be very surprised if you think that. Let's read on. At this, they hardly offered a reply, except they suggested that Christian should pay attention to himself. Then I saw each man move ahead, though with much conversation taking place between them. However, the two intruders did have this to say. As to laws and ordinances, doubtless they were as conscientious in obeying them as he. So they continued, we do not see where you differ from us in the slightest, except for the coat which you are wearing. Most likely was provided by your neighbors to hide your shameful nakedness. Isn't this nailing down the real distinction between these two? Christian says, by obedience to laws and ordinances, you will not be saved, since you did not enter in at the wicket gate. And as for this coat that I wear, it was given to me by the Lord of the celestial city to which I am going. Yes, it is for the purpose of covering my nakedness. And furthermore, I accept it as a token of his kindness granted to me when I earlier wore nothing but rags. Besides, this garment comforts me as I travel. I muse about that time when I shall eventually arrive at the gate of the celestial city. Surely the Lord will recognize me on account of my wearing his coat, that which he freely gave me on the day when he stripped me of my rags. My Savior will see that as I knock at that door, that he'll see me dressed in his righteousness and he will bid me enter. Moreover, I have a mark on my forehead, which you may not have noticed. It was placed on me by one of my Lord's most intimate associates on the same day when my burden fell from off my shoulders. In addition to this, I have been given a sealed scroll to be read for comfort as I continue along the way. I have been ordered to hand it in at the gate of the celestial city as a token of my authorization to enter. No certificate, no entry. However, I doubt if you desire any of these things, though you do lack them, because you did not enter in at the wicket gate. It's very emphatic. Bunyan is saying this is the essential distinction between a true and a counterfeit pilgrim. Entrance through Christ, who is the gate, who is the way, is the one even who drags you in. Paragraph D, to these comments they did not make a reply, except they just looked at each other and they burst out laughing. Ha ha, you believe in that substitutionary atonement idea? That's just a Jewish fable, that's merely Paul's rabbinic teaching, that's all. Then I noticed that they all continued to press forward, though Christian moved ahead of them on his own, so not talking with these strangers any longer. He could only muse with himself, sometimes groaning and at other times expressing contentment. For further refreshment, he would often read from the scroll earlier given to him by one of the shining ones, the assurance of the Spirit of God. Romans 8, his Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. Over the page. Christian ascends the hill difficult. Now I understood that they all continued on till they came to the foot of a hill, at the bottom of which was a spring. At this same place, two other ways joined with the straight way coming from the wicket gate. One turned to the left hand, the other to the right, at the bottom of the hill. However, the narrow way continued straight up the hill, its name being difficulty. Now here you see a familiar method of Bunyan is moving to another scene, but yet he associates it with what's preceded. You've got formalist and hypocrisy trundling on behind, all right? Are we finished with them? No, we're not. When they come to the hill difficulty, while Christian will go up the straight way, what are these other two going to do? Which way do you think they'll go? So Christian first drank at the spring for refreshment, notice, a means of grace provided for weary travelers before they ascend the hill difficulty. Then they commenced to climb up the hill, saying, then he commenced, that is, this hill, though high, I covet to ascend. The difficulty will not me offend, for I perceive the way to life lies here. Come, pluck up heart, let's neither faint nor fear. Better, though difficult, the right way to go, than wrong, though easy, where the end is woe. You've got a choice of three ways. To the left, to the right, or straight ahead, up the hill difficult. Thus formless hypocrisy also came to the foot of the hill. Here they saw that it was steep and high and that there were two alternative ways for them to go along, which they imagined would later join in with the way of Christian beyond the hill. So they decided to follow what appeared to them to be the easier route. The name of one was danger, the name of the other destruction. So one proceeded along danger, which led him into a great wood. The other went along destruction, which entered a wide field full of dark mountains, and there he stumbled and fell, never to rise again. Now, for Christian, going up the hill difficulty, indeed, does present difficulty. And there are remedies provided. Look In paragraph C, a little further down there, now about halfway up the hill, was a pleasant arbor, a shady resting place, provided by the Lord of the hill for the refreshment of weary travelers. It's for the refreshment, not for their over-refreshment. So Christian reached his shelter, where he then sat down to rest a while. Then he pulled his scroll out of his chest pocket and began to read it for comfort. He also took a fresh look at his new garment, which was given to him as he stood before the cross. Notice again, he's doing well. These are right matters to consider when we have difficulty, you see. The testing of the Spirit of God. The robe of Christ's righteousness. Thus, being pleasantly stimulated for a time, he at first snoozed and then fell fast asleep as a result. He was detained at that place until near sunset, while at the same time his scroll fell out of his hand. Now as he was sleeping, someone approached and awakened him with a call. Go to the ant, you sluggard, and consider his ways and be wise. At this, Christian arose with a jolt, started on his way, racing ahead until he came up to the top of the hill. Well, it's wise that he didn't continue in fellowship with, formalist and hypocrisy. Be that as it may, now he loses his role. When he loses his role, he gets into trouble. Now, you've got to address this allegorically. I mean, you can say, what? He loses the Spirit of God? Is that the pick? No. What it means is his indulgence on the hill means he is, as it were, grieving the Spirit. You can grieve the Spirit, you can quench the Spirit. And his overindulgence, taking advantage of what was provided there by the Lord of the hill, overusing the resting place, therefore led to him indulging the flesh, and that is pictured here by the losing, you see, of his role in his carnality. Let's turn over the page now, and we are brought to some other characters. This is all weaving. The story is woven together in different threads. Let's look at this here on page 66. Now, when Christian arrived at the top of the hill, two men came running toward him in full flight from the opposite direction. The name of one was Timorous and the other was Mistrust. Now, I love the way Bunyan weaves in the truth here, that having neglected, as it were, the Spirit, grieved the Spirit, indulged himself too much in the hill, difficulty there. Therefore, his picture is going up the hill and he hasn't got his scroll, you see. And who does he meet at the top there? These two characters, Timorous and Mistrust. And when a person grieves the Spirit, quenches the Spirit, what sort of results in my life will come forth? And Bunyan pictures it here as timorousness and unbelief or mistrust. Do you see the point? Where carnality leads me, when my neglect of the inner witness of the Spirit, again, I neglect that, then comes in a timorousness, a fearfulness, a hesitancy, no boldness, you see. Mistrust, you see, lack of confidence and so forth. Well, now this is put in the realm of these two characters who he meets at the top of the hill. They're going back. They're going the opposite direction. Their names are Timorous and Mistrust. To these, Christian inquired, "Sirs, what is the matter since you are both running the wrong way?" Hence Timorous replied, "We are making our pilgrimage toward the city of Zion, and had reached beyond this till difficulty, but then further we went, the more danger we encountered. As a result, we decided to turn about and return home. So we are now fast on our way." Then Mistrust added, "Yes, this is true, for just ahead of you, lying directly in the way, is a couple of lions. We are not sure if they were awake or asleep. Nevertheless, the prospect of our being torn in pieces seemed too real." They are injecting fear, injecting mistrust. "Christian, you make me afraid. On the other hand, where else shall I run to for safety? If I return to my home in the city of destruction, which region is destined for the judgment of fire and brimstone, then I will certainly perish. However, if I can eventually reach the celestial city, then my safety is assured there. Therefore, I must press forward in spite of risks and perils. To go back is certainly to suffer death, but to go forward, though fear of death will threaten along the way, is yet to have the prospect of everlasting life beyond. So I will definitely go forward. You've got to say that this is sanctified reasoning. Retreat is certain destruction and judgment. Go ahead, danger, yes, but there's still the hope of the celestial city. I'll go ahead. So mistrust and timorous ran down the hill while Christian went on ahead. Even so, in remembering that he had just heard from these men, he felt for his scroll in his chest pocket so that he might read it and be comforted. But to his great surprise, the scroll was not to be found. As a result, Christian became very distressed and did not know what to do. A little further down there. So falling down on his knees, he asked God for forgiveness due to his foolish neglect and commenced to return down the hill looking for his scroll. But oh, who could imagine just how sorrowful of heart he was every step of the way. Sometimes he sighed, sometimes he wept, and often he rebuked himself for his being so foolish as to sleep at length at that place which had only been erected for the purpose of modest refreshment from weariness. It's interesting that Christian is having this trial on the hill difficulty. We will see later on when Faithful comes this same route. He won't have the same problem. He'll have an entirely different challenge. He'll meet a man called Old Adam the First. This is the way Bunyan weaves in for pilgrims different confrontation. In fact, I would say you'll find that, frankly, Faithful proves to be one who is far more troubled with mere overt fleshly temptations like Madam Wanton, and then he gets challenged with Old Adam the First and his three daughters. You know, lust of the flesh, pride of life, etc. And he characterizes his characters here with distinctive ways. And we'll see this later on. All right, let's turn over the page now. Page 68. Therefore, he went back further and further, carefully looking on this side and on that, ever so eager to find his scroll, which had so often given him comfort on his journey. Then Christian continued downhill until the shady resting place, where he had earlier sat and slept, came into view. At this sight, his sorrow increased, and with the more vivid remembrance of his wicked indulgence. So he continued on bemoaning his sinful sleep and lamenting, "O wretched man that I am!" A la Romans 7, all right? O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this flesh? O wretched man that I am, that I should sleep in the daytime, that I should sleep in the midst of difficulty, that I should so indulge the flesh as to allow rest, which the Lord of the hill has provided only for the relief of pilgrim spirits, and thus give place to carnal ease. Now I had needlessly taken these recent steps, even as Israel in the same manner was required to wander and return again by way of the Red Sea on account of their sin. You notice the word carnal ease, you see? And when we are at ease in carnality, we grieve the Spirit, we quench the Spirit, and this, you see, is pictured by the loss of his role, the loss of his assurance. A little further down there, I must tread these steps three times instead of once. Again, he's a real thinker here. He says, I've gone up once, but I've got to go back. Retrieve the scroll, I've got to go up three times instead of one on the hill difficulty. What a fool I am. See. Further, now the night is about to overtake me since the day is almost spent. Oh, that I had not slept. Now by this time, he had come to the shady resting place once again, where he sat down for a time and wept. But at last, as Christian would have it, while remaining downcast and looking under the sea, there he caught sight of his scroll. Now trembling with excitement, he immediately seized it and thrust it into his chest pocket. And who can possibly tell just how joyful this man was when he recovers his scroll? For this scroll was the assurance of his life and the token of his acceptance at the desired haven. And you see that pure relationship is recovered here. In his carnality, he's lost assurance, you see. And that's so often. Sin will undoubtedly very much challenge your assurance of heaven without a question. It'll always do that. Therefore, Christian, having returned his scroll to his chest pocket, offered fervent thanks to God for his directing of his eyes to the place where it had fallen. So with joy and tears, he now focused upon moving ahead in his journey. But oh, how nimbly did he now go up the rest of the hill. Yet before he reached the top, the sun began to set upon Christian. So again he was made to painfully recall the foolishness of his delaying sleep, for he ought to have been much farther ahead for now. There's a sense of itinerary set for him here. And because this delay has come into his life, the sun is setting. What's going to happen with the sun setting? Darkness will come. And how can you travel in the darkness? If he'd been a little further ahead, he would have been able to spend the night at the Palace Beautiful outside of the darkness, you see? But his sin has caused him to travel in more darkness. For this reason, he continued to condole or grieve with himself. Oh, how sinful you are. Oh, sleep, on account of you, my journey in the light has been overcome by the night. Further down the bottom there. Hence he nervously went on his way, but while he was mourning over his fearful turn of events, on lifting up his eyes, he noticed a very regal palace directly ahead of him. Now the name of it was the Palace Beautiful, and it stood just to one side of the highway. Now we come again to one of these great segments of the Pilgrim's Progress. Once I open it up to you, and even I'm going to introduce to you just the introductory thought, and you begin to filter all this through this basic understanding of what the Palace Beautiful is, you'll be amazed, and you'll gain a picture of what a local church ought to be. You have a picture in the Palace Beautiful of an ideal, biblical, faithful local church. That's what the Palace Beautiful is, you see. If he'd been a little more careful on the hill difficulty, he would have traveled in the day and arrived for safety at the Palace Beautiful during the night, you see. That's the point here. Over the page. But first of all, he's got to pass between these lions. The initial question is, of course, who are the lions? Clearly, you see, what they're doing above all else is trying to dissuade the pilgrim from going along to gain entrance into the Palace Beautiful. Let's read here. So I saw in my dream that Christian hurried along toward the palace since he hoped to obtain lodging there. Now before he had gone very far, he entered into an extremely narrow passage, which was only a furlong away from the porter's lodge. And carefully proceeding along this restricted part of the highway, he perceived not far ahead two lions that seemed to stand in his way. Then Christian realized, now I see the danger that caused mistrust and timorous to turn back and flee. Although he did not detect the chains that restricted these ferocious beasts, the restraining sovereignty of Christ in these chains, surely. As a result, he was filled with fear and contemplated going back with them, for at that moment he thought that nothing but death was ahead of him. But the porter named Watchful at the palace lodge, in noticing the Christian hesitated, as if contemplating a retreat on account of the prospect of death ahead of him, called out to him, saying, "Are your strength and courage so small? Don't be so afraid of the lions, since they are in fact chained. Their being there is for the purpose of testing your faith at this point in your journey, as well as for the discovery of those who are faithless. So keep in the middle of the path, and you will not be harmed." Then I saw that Christian went forward on his way. Though trembling because of his fear of the lions, yet he was careful to follow the directions of the porter. Yes, the lions roared and snarled, but they are unable to harm him. As a result, he joyously clapped his hands and went on till he stood before the palace gate where the porter awaited him. What are the lions? Do you remember I mentioned, I think, yesterday that in Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, right at the beginning there, he testifies as he writes that he is like food stuck in the teeth of the lions. Remember that? And that means that he is an irritant to the state church of England, and it's therefore, it's
this one organization, which is both the Church of England and the government of the time, you know, and under the king and the monarchy and so forth. And they are embarrassed by Johnny's in prison and so forth, and they want him just to keep quiet, you know. But he won't keep quiet, you know. He's an irritant to them. He's very popular. He's a good preacher, you know. He's an embarrassment to them. Look on the right-hand page there. The lions of today speak of ideological and personal tyranny. Up above that, you've got the lions of Bunyan's day speak of civil and ecclesiastical tyranny. And you see, what here the lions are doing is trying desperately to stop a pilgrim attend a nonconformist, faithful biblical church. State church wants to stop pilgrims going to such places. That's the picture here. But for the pilgrim who is faithful, who keeps on the straight path, he will go on and gain entrance and find comfort in the faithful local church. I've put down there the ideological tyrants of today, such as institutions of higher learning that have departed from a godly heritage. There are sects and philosophy and rationalism, political causes, socialism, secular utopianism, evolution, materialism, humanism, etc. These are all those movements that would endeavor to stop a believer today attending a good, faithful local church. The personal tyrants, Alexander White, declares that the fiercest of all our lions is our own sin. Then there are wrong priorities, pride, self-sufficiency, intellectualism, carnality, guilt, recreational indulgence, ambition, worldliness, etc. All detract from nurture in a faithful local church. Now we move on. We come actually to entrance into this local church, the Palace Beautiful, in page 72. Then Christian spoke to the porter, "Sir, what is the purpose of this church, and may I reside here for the night?" The porter answered, "This house was built by the Lord of the Hill. He built it for the relief and security of the pilgrims, as it were, as an oasis in a dry and weary land." That's what a local church ought to be. He built it. Notice that. He built it for the relief and security of pilgrims. Jesus Christ said, "I will build my church." Further down, Christian says, "My name is now Christian, though it was graceless to begin with." This is his looking back in retrospect at what he was in the city of destruction. He really was totally without grace and hope then. "My name is now Christian, though it was graceless to begin with. I was born of the race of Japheth, who God will persuade to dwell in the tents of Shem." Now, actually, we have this all recorded in Genesis chapter 9, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And what he's basically saying, "I am a Japhethite, and I therefore am a Gentile, but through my faith in the God of Abraham and his son, therefore I will be persuaded to dwell in the tents of Shem, the Shemites." Who are the Shemites in context? They are the Jewish people. "So that I am a Gentile, but by faith in the God of Abraham and his son, I will be engrafted and become, therefore, engrafted into the root of Abraham," you see, into the root of the Shemites. You see, that's what he's doing here. "But how has it happened that you have arrived so late, since the sun has already set? I ought to have been here sooner, but oh, wretched man that I am." Romans 7 again, you see. "I overslept at the shady resting place that is located on the side of the hill difficulty. Yet in spite of that, I would have been here much sooner, except that, as I said, I lost my scroll of certification and reached," that is his evidence, "and reached the top of the hill without it. Then searching for it, I was dismayed to find that it had gone. So I was forced with the heaviness of heart to return to the place where I overslept," etc. Drop down now further down there where this lady then further investigates him. The porter then introduces him to a beautiful lady called Discretion, and she comes out and meets him. He still hasn't gained entrance yet. Notice this. Further down, "So she smiled, though tears welled up in her eyes, when she heard his testimony. She was very moved and sympathetic with what he'd been through. I think she thought, here is a true pilgrim. But she wasn't sure, you see. After a little hesitation, she said, I will call here two or three more of the family. So she ran to an inner door and called out to Prudence, Piety, and Charity, who after a little more conversation with him, invited Christian inside to meet the rest of the family. Now, this may be an allusion to those three Christian ladies he met on a sunny day in Bedford. You read about it in Grace Abounding. Remember, he didn't know what they were talking about, and he asked them, you know, what's this language? What are you talking about, being born again and so forth? And he knew nothing about this, you see. And they talked to him, and eventually they invited him to come to their church and meet their pastor. Now, look what happens here, you see. So he ran to the inner door and called out to Prudence and Piety and Charity, who, after a little more conversation, invited Christian inside to meet the rest of the family. Sort of some allusion there to that. As a result, many of the residents met him in the lobby and warmly beckoned, come in, you who are blessed of the Lord. This house was built by the Lord of the Hill for the express purpose of entertaining pilgrims such as yourself. Then Christian bowed his head in acknowledgement and followed them into the main part of the house. Now, on the right, in the application there, on the right-hand page there, for Bunyan to become a member of a local church was just not a quick affair. Where you say, I believe in Jesus and I've been baptized and that's it. No, they wanted to be assured that as a believer you were truly regenerate. The Spirit of God dwelt in your heart. There was a real inner evidence in your soul that you had been saved, you see. And I put this here, membership and the independent Bedford Church. Bunyan drew the house rules of the Palace Beautiful from his own church, for it appears that those who desired to join the Bedford Church had to wait outside till they were called in following the congregation's deliberation and investigation. I read once, I remember this even, the biography of D.L. Moody by his son Will Moody. I think you'll find it there, where in Chicago, Moody as a young man sought membership in a local church there. They turned him down. Later on, he came back and they received him in a membership. That's good. We're looking for signs of true conversion. A person is truly a believer. The Spirit of God has given life to their soul. They are right with God and they are alive unto God. They're the two categories that you cannot divide that you're looking for in a new convert. Being right with God through faith and justification therefore through Christ, and life with God, regeneration. Dead to sin and alive unto God. Though a newborn babe, they still must be alive unto God and right with God. All right, that's what's going on here. Let's turn over the page now. Page 74. So when he had come inside and sat down, they gave him something to drink. Now we learn, you know, all that goes on in the palace bed. This is marvelous. This is just marvelous. Then they all agreed that until supper was ready, now you've got to ask, what's supper time here? Think about that. And until supper was ready, it would be a profitable use of their time if one or two of them should have conversation with Christian about some specific matters. So Piety, Prudence, and Charity were appointed to have discussion with him, and so they began. Come now, good Christian, since we have been so loving toward you by receiving you into our house tonight, let us profitably spend our time amongst ourselves by talking with you about all the things that have happened to you in your pilgrimage. And he then again gives account of his leaving the city of destruction. Look at further down there, Piety says, how did it come about that you came out of your country in this direction? It was as God would have it. It was one of these occasions. This, incidentally, a number of occasions, the Calvinism of Bunyan comes out with this little expression, but as God would have it. It means really simply, in the pure, sovereign providence and grace of God. Not according, well, I made my decision. I made my decision. I'm very happy about that, you know. If I hadn't made my decision, I wouldn't be a Christian. But I made my decision, so that makes me a Christian now. You don't find that in the Bible. Bunyan puts it, it was as God would have it. I am what I am by the grace of God and nothing else, you see. For when I was fearful of destruction hovering over me, I did not know which way to go. But through providence there came a man, even to me as I was trembling and weeping, whose name was Evangelist. And he directed me toward the wicket gate, otherwise I would not have found it. And so at the same time he pointed out the way that has led me directly to this palace. But did you not come by the way of the house of the interpreter? Yes, and the things that I saw there were truly memorable. They will stay with me as long as I live, and especially three scenes. They were how Christ, in opposition to Satan, maintains the work of grace in the heart. How the man in the iron cage had sinned himself quite out of the hope of God's mercy. And also the dream of the man who thought in his sleep that the day of judgment had come. Further down, Christian says, halfway down, my mind and heart were both totally ravished at the sight of these things. I could have stayed at that good man's house for a year, except that I knew that I still had a distance to go. Do you see again another indication of true conversion having come in through the wicket gate? He loves the ministry of the Spirit. He loves the instruction the Spirit of Christ reveals to him out of Scripture, you see. Loves that. An unregenerate person does not love that. Now, what else did you see along the way? See why I had also gone a short distance ahead when I saw, as it were, in my mind, a man hanging bleeding on a tree. Now, I want you to notice this. When he recalls that place of deliverance, he now sees more than he ever saw at that time. When he was a place of deliverance, you don't have a description of a man hanging bleeding on a tree. But now he describes that place. He's got a little more clear focus on what was on that hill, you see. The very sight of him made my burden fall from off my back, which load had caused me to groan so much. Yes, it did actually drop from off my back. It was so astonishing to me because I'd never seen such a thing before. Yes, and while I was looking up at that tree, for I could not stop looking, three shining ones came to me. One of them declared that my sins had been forgiven. Another stripped me of my rags and gave me this embroidered coat. There is again. When he was the place to deliver, he was given a cloak. He wasn't told it was an embroidered coat. What is Bunyan teaching you? That the more we go along this pilgrim way as Christians and we contemplate on the atonement of Christ, all the aspects of the death, burial, resurrection, ascension and session of Christ, the more we perceive that through Paul in Romans and Galatians and Ephesians, etc., the more we look at that, the more we see it more attractively. It is not a cloak, it is an embroidered coat. As you can see, and the third set a visible mark upon my forehead and gave me the sealed scroll which I keep in my chest pocket. We turn over the page. Left-hand column, a little way down. Truly, if it had not been for that good man, your porter watchful who stands at the gate. Who is watchful? Probably an elder in the church. He has a pastoral office there, it would seem to me. It is probable that I would have eventually turned around and fled down the hill. But now I do thank God that I am here and I thank you for welcoming here. I love life in a local church like this. Then Prudence thought of asking Christian a few questions, so she asked him to answer. Do you sometimes think of the country from which you originally came? Yes, but with much shame and loathing, truly, if I had a deep yearning for that country, then I might well have taken the opportunity to return. But now my heart desires a better country, that is a heavenly realm. Therefore I prefer to press on. Do you still not carry with you in your mind some recollection of the things that you were formerly involved with? Yes, but greatly against my will, and especially those inward and carnal reasonings, which all of my countrymen as well as myself were delighted to revel in. But now all those things only grieve me. And should I be able to choose only what I think, I would choose never to think of those carnal things any more. But when I would be doing that which is best, still that which is worse remains with me. The dilemma a true child of God has in perhaps recollection of a sinful past, although I could wipe that out of my memory. You shudder, you tremble at what you were like earlier when you were not a Christian. And you just wonder, how could I be saved? And you grieve and you wish you couldn't think about those things. And then we are lifted up. You'll see him lifted up out of that in a moment. Do you not sometimes find that personal carnality is vanquished when at other times it was of great trouble to you?
Yes, but those times of conquest over carnality are infrequent, though when they do occur, such hours are truly golden. Here's the brutal honesty of Bunyan. Yes, those times of conquest are infrequent. He's not saying what he ought to say to make the lady happy. He's saying what's true. He often has struggles with his flesh and he's not always victorious. But he does have some victory. And when he does, my, he says, they're golden moments indeed. They're precious. They really are, he says, you see. When you experience these precious times in which carnal annoyances are vanquished, can you remember by which means these triumphs were obtained? Now, over on the right-hand page in the outline, I've outlined this. Notice in the middle there. What are the means by which such victories are obtained? He gives four grounds on which he has victory over carnality. One, meditation on the cross. Two, meditation on the coat, the imputed righteousness of Christ. Thirdly, meditation on his scroll, interaction with the very indwelling Spirit of Christ. And then, fourthly, meditation on his destination, the celestial city. The vision to be with Christ is far better. I shall see him as he is, I shall be like him. You see. Then he's asked in the outline again there, look for then, what is it that makes the celestial city so desirable? That's the fourth element right there. What is it that makes the celestial city so desirable? He says, being face to face with the Lord, being free of carnal conflict, being rid of death and possessing eternal life. Over the page. We'll just get to this wonderful scene, then we'll finish this session. A little further down, left-hand column on page 78. Then said Charity Christian, do you have a family? Are you a married man? I have a wife and four small children. Why did you not bring them along with you? Oh, how willingly I would have done so, but they, all of them, were utterly opposed to my going on pilgrimage. And so his question here about his testimony, did you give a good testimony or was your carnality that really restricted your family from seeing the light and at least going on pilgrimage with you? Look at on the right-hand column there, a little way down, Christian says, to be sure, I cannot commend my life, for I am only too well aware of my countless failings in this regard. I also know that a man, by means of this manner of life, may soon negate whatever arguments or good reasons he may strenuously present to others for their good. Even so, I can honestly confess how very careful I was to avoid giving them any reason, that is, with regard to disgraceful behavior on my part, for not going on pilgrimage. In fact, for this cautious attitude, they would criticize me and tell me I was too precise or puritanical in denying myself things, and for their sakes in which they saw no wrong. And I think I can rightly say if there was anything that really did hinder them, it was my own tenderness in being careful not to sin against God or do any wrong to my neighbor. Now, a little way down, now notice they say it's supper time. I, Bunyan, look at it. I, John Bunyan, editorializing, coming in here. I, John Bunyan, saw in my dream that they all sat down together until supper time was ready. What's supper time? It's the Lord's table. See? The table was set with fat and good and substantial things, with wine that was well refined. And all of their conversation at the table was about the Lord of the Hill. For instance, they talked about what he had done and the purpose of it and why he had built that house. And from that they saw that I understood that he had been a great warrior and that he had fought with and slain he who had the power of death, though not without great danger to himself. And for this reason I was led to love him only all the more. For as they said, and as I believe said Christian, he did it with the loss of much blood. Now we'll leave it there, because when we come back in the next session, we'll take it right up there and you'll see how this supper time works out in the most wonderful result in the life of Christian. Not just participating in the Lord's Supper is what counts. It's what the effect it has upon you every time you remember the Lord that way. We'll come back in, we come back, brother, in 15 minutes' time.
We're on the journey.